We mentioned this morning that we were going to be learning about Ed. And some of you may not have thought much of Ed being in the Bible. Anybody got a guess before we get into it as to where in the Bible Ed might be mentioned? What do you think, New Testament or Old Testament? Any guesses? Old Testament. Anybody got a guess for a book? There's only 39 of them in the Old Testament, so surely it's in one of those.
Judges
is a good guess. Joshua is where we actually are tonight. And on the way home, there was Ed. This is nearly the end of the book of Joshua. Joshua 22, verses 1 through 34. Now, I will confess that Ed, technically, in our English Bibles, is not in every translation. It's in the King James and possibly a few others. I know the New King James. What it is Ed is actually the Hebrew word. And it probably was pronounced more like Ayed or something like that than we would pronounce Ed. But something like that. And the King James just transliterates it, which means they take the Hebrew letters, the Hebrew sounds, and put the English letters that make those sounds and put them in there. Most of the other translations translate the word, and that word actually means witness. And so most of them, instead of naming the altar Ed, they name the altar witness. So we'll come to that as we get to the end. But as we get into this, I want us to think back to the time of what's happening. We remember that when Moses and the children of Israel had headed toward Canaan's land, and they got there onto the eastern side, and then they came up to the Jordan River, and they wouldn't cross, and there were a lot of issues with spies and all of those things, and they wound up wandering around for 40 years. And then finally, after Moses dies, Joshua is ready then to take the children of Israel into the Promised Land. But in that 40 years of time, what had happened was that Reuben and Gad and half of the tribe of Manasseh had found that they kind of liked the land on the eastern side of the Jordan River. So if you look at the map, the Jordan River kind of cuts down through there, and on the western side is the Mediterranean Sea and that part of Israel. But then on the eastern side, these folks found that there was some land that was pretty good for their cattle. And so they were already settling in. But Joshua said, look, you promised Moses that you would come and fight with your brethren and help them get their land. And so they said, okay. And they built fences around their cities to protect their women and their children. And the men who were of fighting age, basically 20 to 60, went off to war to conquer the land with their cousins and help them get their part that they were supposed to get. So they've been doing that now for a generation's worth of time. For many years, they've been over there conquering the land, helping their brethren fight to get their part of the Promised Land. And now Joshua has come to them and said, okay, you've done what you were supposed to do. Verse 3, he says, you didn't forsake your brothers all these days down till now. You've kept the charge that God gave you. You've done what God told you to do. You've gone, you've fought, you've helped your brothers and sisters get the land. So now you can go back home. And you can imagine after years of war, we know what it's like when our soldiers go and they're gone for 9 months or 12 months or 18 months or a 2-year tour or something like that. And when they come back home after 2 years, everybody's excited that they've gotten to come back home. And of course, there's some problems that often erupt as well. But everybody's excited that they're getting to come back home. Well, these folks have been gone a lot more than 2 years. They've been gone a multiple number of years, but now they're getting to go back home again. And the last thing that Joshua says to them before blessing them and sending them out is, verse 5, be very careful to observe the commandment and the law that Moses, the servant of the Lord, commanded you, and to love the Lord your God, to walk in His ways, and to keep His commandments, and to cling to Him, and to serve Him with all your heart and all your soul. Sounds kind of similar to something Jesus said to us, didn't it, about the greatest commandment. It's not actually where that comes from, but He's quoting, or at least telling them the same thing that Moses had told them in Deuteronomy. So then He blesses them and He sends them. And now they go to go across the river, and they're ready to go back to their tents. They're ready. They've got some wealth from the wars that they've conquered, helped conquer the land. They've got the spoils of war, and they're ready to go back. And when they go, in verse 10, as they're going back home, they came to the Jordan River, and Reuben, Gad, and half of Manasseh, these men get there, and they build an altar beside the Jordan. It's an altar of, it's a big altar. It's large. You can see it from far away. They build an altar. Now, if we remember, the Israelites were only supposed to worship God at the altar that at this time was in the tabernacle. They were to go to the priest if they had sacrifices. They take those sacrifices to the priest. The priest would offer the sacrifices for them and all of those kind of things. Well, the other tribes see what has happened. And they see these 2.5 tribes, here they are. They have just left us. They haven't even got back home yet. And already they're leaving the Lord. They're already over there building an altar other than the altar at the tabernacle. And this brings us to understand our first lesson tonight. As we come to Ed, we need to learn the tragedy of condemning without investigation. As we look at verses 11 through 14, what we see is the people see, hey, they've built this altar over there. And they've assumed the worst of their brethren. They've assumed, just like we were talking about a moment ago, hey, they've already left the Lord. They're already doing something they shouldn't. And as we look at verses 11 through 14, the people of Israel heard it and they said, the people of Reuben and Gad and half tribe of Manasseh have built an altar at the frontier of the land of Canaan on this side that belongs to the people of Israel. And when the people of Israel heard about it, the whole assembly of Israel gathered at Shiloh to make war against them. They were ready to wipe them out because they've built a false altar over here. But the danger here and the problem here is they were jumping to conclusions. They weren't investigating. They weren't actually trying to find out the truth. There have been some other times in history when that's happened, haven't there? The trials of Jesus are certainly a good example of that. Jesus was set up before at least 6 different trials in one night. And not one time in those 6 was anybody actually interested in finding out the truth. I mean, Pilate might have come the closest when he said, "What is truth?" But then he didn't care for the answer. It didn't matter to him. Certainly the trials of Jesus show us the danger of jumping to conclusions, of not investigating, of not finding the truth. The story is told of a little girl who had been lost in the woods, and family and friends had searched for her, and they had given up, and they'd gone back to the house to regroup. And about that time, the family dog came back home with blood all over his muzzle, all over his mouth. The father, distraught and seeing the dog, grabbed the dog and got his shotgun and he went out and shot that dog. Well, they followed the trail of blood from the dog back, and they found the girl lying there alive and a dead cougar next to her, dead mountain lion. The dog had been defending her and saved her life, but the father jumped to conclusions and assumed the worst of that family dog. How much more tragic it is when we do that with human beings, when we assume that they have done the worst and we don't investigate before reacting. It's a dangerous thing for sure. Well, as we move on there, we see though that they were ready. They weren't just going to go send somebody to condemn them and tell them they were wrong. They were going to go to war. And so the second thing we learn at Ed is the tragedy of war without a cause. You know, constantly in our world, there's dangerous situations that arise and the threat of something, some hostility being taken as an act of war and plunging us into a war somewhere in the world. It's a constant threat. It could happen at any moment. Somebody doing the wrong thing at the wrong time in the wrong place. But as we notice here, they're ready to go to war, and they are about to prepare to do that. Now, fortunately, they stop short, and they send Phinehas, the son of Eleazar the priest, and 10 of the chiefs with him to go to talk before they actually start the fighting. It's a good thing they did, because they didn't have a just cause for that war, even though it appeared that way. And we'll see later exactly what had happened that they were missing. But there are examples of this in the church. All over the world this happens. One of the things that, and even in 1 Corinthians 3, in verses 3 through 6, Paul talks to the church there about the divisions, the wars that they were having amongst themselves. They were fighting over seemingly possibly who had baptized them. But they were saying, I'm following Paul, and I'm following Apollos, and I'm following Cephas. And then others were saying, no, I'm following Jesus. And they were fussing and fighting and just about to tear the church apart, when Paul himself had said, hey, if you're going to follow me, only follow me in the way that I follow Christ. We're all supposed to be following Christ. We shouldn't be following men. Paul said, we're just servants of God. We're not somebody to be following. We are all trying to work together to follow Christ. And we see that so many times, though. People argue and fuss and fight over personality differences, over conflicts and differences of opinion, over things that are misunderstandings and that weren't what was really said or done. Certainly a sad situation when that happens, but it often does. We also learn at Ed that we can badly misjudge others. And we all at times have been guilty of doing this, no doubt. We have assumed the worst about somebody. We have assumed that we knew what they were thinking or what they were feeling or whether they had a pure heart or good intentions or not. And the fact of the matter is, while we can see the actions that people do and determine whether they're right or wrong, we often misjudge when we start trying to go inside another person's head or into their heart to know why they're doing it. And we miss the boat so badly. In verses 15 and 16, remember Phinehas and the 10 chiefs, one from each of the tribes. Now remember, two of the tribes were on the other side, so there are only 10 others. So Eleazar the priest and these 10 chiefs of the tribes go to see the tribes on the other side of the river. Verse 15, they come to those people and they said, this is what the whole congregation of the Lord is saying to you. What is this breach of faith that you've committed against the God of Israel? You've turned away from following the Lord, and you've built this altar in rebellion against the Lord. And they go on in the following verses to point out everybody in history who's ever done something wrong. And they're lumped in with them. You know, how often do we hear, especially recently even, our own politicians of one party or the other refer to some other one as, well, they're like Hitler, they're Nazis. It's easy to jump to conclusions, to misjudge other people's motives, to think we know who they are and what they are. And that's exactly what the children of Israel had done here. And there's you've turned away from God. Don't you remember the sin at Peor? Now, Phinehas remembered that one real well. And the sin at Peor, if you remember, that was Balaam and his donkey. You remember that guy? And he finally figured out how to sneak around and do what God had told him not to do. And he gave the king some advice about how the king of Moab, how to trick the Israelites into betraying God. And so there were women sent into the camp, and the Israelites were worshiping this false god, and they were having relationships with these women from Moab. And it got to the point where one of them came and was right in front of the tabernacle, right in front of the tent of meeting with this woman, flaunting that he was being disobedient. Phinehas took a spear, a javelin, and stabbed them both through and killed them right there in front of the tabernacle. This guy is pretty zealous about, if you're going against God, I'm going to do something about it, isn't he? I mean, most of us would probably shy away from stabbing two people through with a javelin. But he didn't. In that case, he was right to do that. God praised him for doing that. But here now, he's assuming that these brethren are doing the same kind of thing, that they're off following, you built an altar, you're worshiping a false god, you're turning against God. It's a sad thing sometimes when we assume that we were right one time because people did bad things, then we start to see those bad things in everything everybody else does. It's easy for us to become very judgmental toward those folks, to assume that they're doing the wrong thing. As we read on here, he goes on to say, hey, you know, you're doing this thing, and now, in verse 18 he says, and now you must turn away from following the Lord. If you rebel against the Lord today, then tomorrow he'll be angry with the whole congregation of Israel. If the land of your possession is unclean, then you come over to our side then. If you can't live over here and do what's right, then you come across the river with us, is what he says to them. And then he says, hey, you remember that guy Achan? You remember him? Remember what happened to him? He was a bad guy too. He took stuff he wasn't supposed to take. He didn't do what was right. And look, other people suffered. He didn't die by himself. Not only him, his own family, but other people were killed in battle because of him. Innocent people that hadn't done anything. But they died in the battle because of what he had done. Because God was angry with the people. But oh yes, we can badly misjudge others. Remember Samuel and Eli? The story of Samuel's conception, I guess you could say, of as his mother Hannah was praying for him to be born. And Eli saw her, and he saw she's mouth was moved, she's kind of mumbling, she wasn't, and he thought she was drunk, and he accused her of being drunk. He badly misjudged her. She was not drunk at all. She was full of sorrow and pouring her heart out to the Lord. And she was a very godly woman instead. Matthew 7, 1 through 5, Jesus warns us of the dangers of judging And he tells us the way that we judge others is going to determine the way we get judged. And yes, he tells us in John, we need to judge righteous judgment. Don't just judge by sight. Don't just judge by expectations. Any of you part of a family with multiple brothers or sisters, especially if you were one of the younger ones, and as the older ones went through school and you came up behind them, and then you'd come into the class and the teacher'd say, "Oh, you're one of those." They judged you right quick based on who your brothers and sisters were, who your parents were. "Oh, you're going to be a good student because your brother or sister was." "Oh, you're going to be a troublemaker because your brother or sister was." How many times do we misjudge people? The story is told of a man who left home one morning. He stopped. Kind guy. Saw a hitchhiker on the side of the road. Stopped to pick him up. As they talked, the man talked about how he was looking for work, needed some work. Man reached over and got one of his business cards and handed it to him. The hitchhiker pulled his wallet out to put the business card in it. The man noticed that that wallet looked just like his. Well, he felt his pocket, and it was empty. "Well, sure, this guy has stolen my wallet. How dare he? After I was kind enough to pick him up and I'm trying to help him, and he's stolen my wallet." So he reached over and grabbed the wallet away from the man and stopped the car and told him, "Get out of my car." Slammed the door back and took off. Got to his office. There was a message waiting. "You need to call your wife at home." He called home, called his wife. "Honey, you wouldn't believe what just happened to me." She said, "Well, you can tell me about it in just a minute. I just wanted to let you know you left your wallet here by the bed this morning." It's easy to misjudge other people and to assume the worst. It's a dangerous thing when we do that. But another thing that we do notice here as we come to Ed is that Phinehas was right in what he was telling these 2.5 tribes. God tolerates no rival altars. God says, "You serve me, you serve only me, you don't have any other gods beside me, you don't build any altars to anybody but me." 1 Kings 12 and 25 through 33, Jeroboam, after God gave him most of the kingdom of Israel, first thing Jeroboam did was go build golden calves at the south and north ends of his country to keep people from going back to Jerusalem to worship God. And every king of the northern kingdom, every one of them until they were taken into captivity, not a single one ever went away from that. It took Josiah from the south to come up and destroy that false altar with that golden calf. But verses 28 and 29, we see this, that God won't accept shared time. You can't serve Him and serve somebody else. It doesn't work that way. But we see that as well in the things that are being told by Phinehas of the events in the past. And we see it all through the Scriptures. We see time and again this idea that God's not going to allow anyone else. He demands singular service. Matthew 6:24. No one can serve two masters. You can't serve God and money. 1 Peter 3:15. In your hearts, honor Christ the Lord as holy. You set Him apart. You give Him a special place. Jesus said, "You shall worship the Lord your God, and Him only shall you serve." Now, God doesn't accept others. So in that, Phinehas was right. Now again, we talked about how they had badly misjudged. Notice back in verse 21. after he had said, he brought up this about, you know, about Achan and about the problems. He said in verse 21, those 2.5 tribes say, "The mighty one, God the Lord, the mighty one, God the Lord, he knows. And let Israel know whether it was in rebellion or a breach of faith against the Lord. If it was, do not spare us today for building an altar to turn away from following the Lord, or if we did it to burn offerings or grain offerings or peace offerings on it. May the Lord Himself take vengeance. No, that's not why we did it." They say, "You've misjudged us. That's not why we did it." And so we learn now another lesson. Concern for those yet unborn. Are we concerned for future generations that haven't even been born yet? They were. They said in verse 24, "No, but we did it from fear that in time to come, your children might say to our children." Now obviously, these are children that haven't even been born yet. The ones that are alive now, they know each other. "But in the future, your children might say to our children, look, we don't have anything to do with one another. You don't belong to the Lord. Look, this Jordan River is a boundary. It's a dividing line, and you're on the other side of it, so you're obviously not one of us. You're not part of us." And they were concerned about that. And so he said, "Your children might make our children cease worshiping the Lord. And so we said, let's build an altar not for burnt offering or for sacrifice, but to be a witness between us and you and between our generations after us that we do perform the service of the Lord in His presence with our burnt offerings and sacrifices and peace offerings, so that your children will not say to our children, you have no part in the Lord." And we thought, if this should be said to us or to our descendants in time to come, we should say, "Behold the copy of the altar of the Lord, which our fathers made, not for burnt offerings, not for sacrifice, but to be a witness between us and you." And so we didn't build this to offer sacrifices on it or to worship any false gods. We built this as a monument to remember, a memorial, to remind our children and your children that we serve the same God, that we're part of the same people. They were concerned for those children that hadn't been born yet. Just like with Achan, it's possible for us to perish, but not alone. We're going to influence others that come after us. It's possible that entire groups of people could be wiped out as a result of our sinfulness. Ahab, we've been studying on Sunday morning and how he's defeated and God has promised, "Hey, you know what? I'm going to wipe out your entire family line. There's not going to be anybody left." There's nobody today who can say, "You know, I descended from King Ahab." Huh? Nobody. Because all of his descendants were wiped out. One judge, and it's been several years ago, things I'm sure have changed now to some degree, but Judge Tatum in Alabama once said, "Discipline neglected in the high chair ends up in the electric chair." We need to be concerned for the young and for those to come. He said that of all the juvenile delinquents that had come through his court, only one had been taken to church regularly. Says something about a good upbringing, doesn't it? Can help you avoid a lot of problems. Will it mean they'll never do anything wrong? No. But it sure can help the odds. Exodus 20, verses 1 through 6. God reminds the people not to have any other gods. He reminds them not to bow down to them, serve them, not to do anything. He says, I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, in verse 5, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and fourth generation of them that hate me. He said, you know, you're going, your children and your children's children, and all, they're going to suffer if you turn against me. And certainly that is the case with many. But then he says, showing steadfast love to thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments. We need to teach the young to obey the Lord. Ephesians 6, 1 through 4, again, children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. In Exodus 1 and verse 8, we find a new king rose up that didn't know Joseph. He didn't realize that Joseph had saved his entire land. He didn't realize who all of these Hebrew people, why are they here? He didn't know the story. He didn't know the history. And because he didn't know it, he treated them as enemies instead of friends. And that led, of course, to the captivity in Egypt and the slavery in Egypt. But we see here also that there is a pattern. In verse 28 there, when they said, this is what we're going to say, look at the copy. Look at the pattern that we've made this altar that looks just like that altar that they have over there because we're the same. It's a remembrance. Well, there is a pattern. There is a certain way that God wants things done. They recognized that, and so they weren't going to break that, but they were just making a model of the real altar to remind their children of that. Hebrews 8:5 talks about the things from the old law and how they serve as a copy, as a pattern, and a shadow of the heavenly things. Moses was told, make everything according to the pattern that was shown to you in the mountain. Always following the pattern. 2 Timothy chapter 1 and verse 13. Paul tells Timothy, follow the pattern of the sound words that you've heard from me. Follow that. Look at the pattern. Look at what the Bible describes and follow that. Romans 6 and verse 17 says, you have obeyed from the heart the pattern, the standard, the plan. You know, it's difficult to build something without a plan. It's hard to get where you're going if you don't know where you're trying to go. There is a pattern. God has a pattern for every area where He wants us to please Him. And we need to follow that pattern. And then, of course, the final thing that we want to realize here is the need to long for and rejoice in unity. In our society today, much like many societies in the past, unity is in short supply. It seems like there's strife and disagreement and fussing and fighting constantly. But in verses 30 through 34, when Phinehas and the chiefs of the congregation heard these things, and the people of Gad and Manasseh and Reuben had said these things, it was good in their eyes. And they said, today we know the Lord is in our midst. You have not committed a break in the faith against the Lord. You've delivered the people of Israel from the hand of the Lord. And Phinehas and the chiefs returned back across the river and brought the message back. And there wasn't a war and no one died. But think about how close they came. How near it was to all-out war between brethren. The people of Israel blessed God and spoke no more of making war against them. And the people of Reuben, Gad and Manasseh called the altar Ed, or as most translations translate it, witness. It was a witness for them. For they said, it is a witness between us that the Lord is God. We need to long for and rejoice in unity. Psalm 133 is a pretty short psalm. It's only 3 verses long, but it's a beautiful one. David says, behold how good and pleasant it is when brothers dwell in unity. It's like the precious oil on the head running down on the beard of Aaron, running down on the collar of his robes. It's like the dew of Mount Hermon, which falls on the mountains of Zion. For there the Lord has commanded the blessing, life forevermore. Oh yes, unity is a beautiful thing. Ephesians 4, verses 2 and 3, Paul reminds the Christians there to live with all humility and gentleness and with patience, bearing with one another in love, being eager to maintain the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. Peace and unity. In short supply in our world, but if there's one place that we should have peace and unity, it's in the Lord's body, His church. And we need to strive for that. We need to encourage one another in that direction. Let's remember the lessons that we learned from Ed. If you've learned something tonight that you need to put into practice in your life and you need the prayers of the church to help you do that, if you have some other need or some other problem in your life that you need to come and ask prayers for, whatever your need may be, if you have a need, please come as we stand and as we sing.